From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Ethan Hawke was working on The Magnificent Seven when a crew member who was reading The Good Lord Bird told him he was the right man to play abolitionist John Brown. Hawke picked up the award-winning novel, which follows Brown's story through the eyes of an escaped slave, that day, and he quickly became jealous of author James McBride's storytelling.
I was like, okay, just give it up, Ethan, just give it up. And then it just got better and better. And I realized, like, well, all right, I can't have written this, but I could act the hell out.
Hawke tells us about the fight to make the new Showtime series a high wire act in terms of tone. And McBride, who entrusted his book to Hawke based on a handshake, tells us it was worth it. But first on the News Banter, we'd like to bring you some good news, but the news is not good. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So I feel like there's just the same bad story week after week, Matt. It's there's no place to rest your gaze. At Warner's, we have Warner Media is going to do another major layoff. And I think they will be rearranging who is in charge of what at that place. As they have already begun, Jason Kilar, who came from Hulu, has reassembled his crew from Hulu. And I think they are going to be making further changes. They have had some pretty drastic changes not that long ago by surprising too many people, dropping Bob Greenblatt, who had an absolute top job there at HBO Max, and Kevin Reilly, an industry veteran, who they also dropped, less surprisingly. Meanwhile, another shakeup and ongoing changing of everything at NBC Universal. We've talked about all the issues that they've had. They have just brought in Susan Rovner from Warner Brothers, who ran their television at a very high-level job. There are going to be, again, major layoffs, major rearrangements. They are trying to reshape their company to adapt to this era, the streaming era. Peacock is the place. I mean, all of these companies are fixated on their streaming services. And finally, you know, we'll look at Disney right now. They have a problem on their hands, but you could argue, or maybe it's a wonderful thing that's going to help them. But activist shareholder Daniel Loeb has come onto the scene, and he is demanding that they stop paying a dividend and put all their energy into the streaming service.
Yeah, the Loeb thing is interesting because he's essentially arguing that Disney Plus, which has had an amazingly successful first year, surpassing subscriber expectations. They have had success with the Star Wars series, Mandalorian. But if you look at Disney Plus, it is not competitive to Netflix from a content perspective. There is not this fire hose of new stuff that is coming online once a day, once a week. And if you look at the user interface of Disney Plus, most of the time, the top performing content is The Simpsons or Moana or Toy Story, or these legacy Disney projects. And the engagement, especially among people older than 10 years old, is much lower. So Loeb's argument is, forget these flailing cable networks that'll all be gone in 10 years anyways. Forget these movie theaters that are closed right now. Pour all your money into the future, which is streaming, and create a service that is going to be competitive to what Netflix offers and give them a run for their money in being the dominant streamer.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just note that The Simpsons, as we know, it was from Fox and Disney acquired it. But yes, it's older material. And what we're looking at is a problem, though. This industry, you know, has had a model that has made a lot of money for a lot of people for a long time of releasing big movies in the theaters. And there is this argument, just put them on demand, put them on demand. Disney tried it with Mulan, charging an extra $30. It didn't go particularly well, except maybe as an experiment. The problem with Hollywood, of course, is that everybody extrapolates and goes, well, that was really scary. That didn't really work. And, therefore, maybe we shouldn't do it. So therefore, there's no proof that taking an expensive $200 million movie, a blockbuster, can work. On the other side of the coin, Warner Brothers, at the behest of Christopher Nolan, absolutely insisted on opening Tenet in theaters, and that didn't go that well either. Now, it's entirely possible people weren't that keen to see Mulan, people weren't that keen to see Tenet, and that's the real reason. But Hollywood extrapolates lessons based on one thing that is unique, and I'm not sure that works. Having said all of that, I will still say no one has figured out how to take a blockbuster and open it and ensure that you will get a piece of your money back, a decent piece, by putting it on demand. And I don't know. And you have not seen a single major movie. We just saw Bond finally move. You know, MGM needs that money. They did not want, they couldn't open the movie in theaters. They moved. Jurassic World is like a poster child. They were supposed to have the whole pandemic thing figured out. They had protocols. They were talking about their great protocols. They took out a hotel. They had teams. They had this, that, and the other. They've had to shut down. So did the Batman, the Warner Brothers movie. The industry is just stuck in the most horrible place. And the only thing that seems consistent right now is that jobs are being lost.
Well, and that everyone's chasing Netflix. And the Netflix model hasn't even borne out yet, because as we know,
Exactly.
Netflix is being fueled by an incredible run-up in its stock price, which is being fueled by its growth in subscribers, which is being fueled by the content that is being funded by massive amounts of debt. So, you know, Netflix could be leading everyone off a cliff here, or it could be the future, which is what everyone thinks right now. And you've got to refocus these companies and dramatically remake them to turn into streaming services. And that is going to be the narrative for the next few years, and it's going to cause massive layoffs.
It already is. And, you know, just to show that this is not affecting a single sector, looking just at Disney, for example, you know, we have talked about how they pressed Gavin Newsom to open Disneyland. He's not doing it at this time. He's saying, nope, not going to do it. And ESPN, sports viewing is way off for reasons that, you know, many people speculate about. So certainly the cruise ships aren't going. I don't envy anybody having to try to run these companies right now. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
Everybody got God on their side in the war. Trouble is, God ain't telling nobody who he's for.
My name is Captain John Brown! And I am here in the name of the great King of Kings!
Ethan Hawke's new series, The Good Lord Bird, tells the tale of abolitionist John Brown through the eyes of a fictional young enslaved person who Brown liberates, killing the child's father in the process. Mistaking the boy for a girl, Brown dubs his young protege Little Onion, played in the series by newcomer Joshua Caleb Johnson. Ethan Hawke, of course, plays Brown. Brown's 1859 raid on Harper's Ferry has been called the dress rehearsal for the Civil War. Believing he was sent by God to end slavery, Brown did not hesitate to kill for his cause, and of course he led his militia to its doom. That may not sound like material for a comedic novel, but that's just what author James McBride undertook when he wrote The Good Lord Bird. The novel won the National Book Award for Fiction in 2013. Our guests today are McBride and Ethan Hawke, who co-wrote and produced The Good Lord Bird. Hawke says even before he read the book, he had a feeling about this one.
When I first heard the title, I had a strange ripple go up my spine. Mm. I didn't let it drop. I kept trying, you know, I people mention books to me every day. I don't know why I went out and bought that one that day, and something hit me about it.
I mean, did you know the story of John Brown? I remember being taken to Harper's Ferry as a kid. I grew up in DC and kind of not getting it at that point, what it meant. I think as a figure, he's somewhat been marginalized in the history books, but did you have a sense of John Brown going into reading The Good Luck Bird?
You know, he wasn't somewhat marginalized. He was deliberately marginalized in the kind of country's gentleman agreement to try to get along after the Civil War. They really tried to hide John Brown, because if you teach people about John Brown, you have to teach them about slavery. And it was something people wanted to turn their eyes away from. I think the little bit I knew about him was that he was a lunatic terrorist. You know, that was the kind of thing I had heard originally. And slowly over time, I got more informed, but I still didn't know much until I read James's book.
James, so Ethan, when he approaches you, as I understand it, having read a great piece about Ethan in The New Yorker, he said to you, and you can correct this, Ethan, if it's not quite right, but it sounds right. I'm not Brad Pitt. I can't afford to option this novel for the money that it deserves. And you then make a handshake deal. I mean, were you thinking, what were you thinking when he said that to you?
I just felt, you know, he was an honest guy, and his reputation was, you know, is a great one. I mean, and he obviously is very, Ethan understood the book. He understood what the book was trying to say. And so that's all I needed to hear. I didn't write the book for money. I wrote it because I want people to love each other. And, anyone who's ever met Ethan knows that he's got a big heart and he really means it. And I said, why not? You know, we were like 10 blocks from my church. He came to visit the church. They thought he was the guy who came to fix the air conditioner.
And yeah, I saw that. Ethan didn't get upset about that. You probably felt bad you couldn't fix the air conditioner, but go on.
He probably would have. They'd asked him. I mean, he thought it was funny. It was funny. In our business, you know, the storytelling business, you know, when you meet a fellow soldier, you know whether or not they're wearing the stars and stripes for real. It doesn't take long to figure it out. So it didn't take me but a minute to figure it out. And I was so delighted that he was interested, that he understood what the book was trying to do. And I was so pleased that he decided to take it on, you know, and at the urging of his wife. And I just thought it was great. So I wasn't worried about the handshake deal. And, you know, it didn't matter, you know. Mm.
The interesting thing is that when people show you respect, it becomes reciprocal. I mean, the respect and dignity with which James treated me and my desires as an artist made me want to serve his work two times more. I mean, the funny thing, you know, I don't know if I've ever said this to you, James, I probably did, but I'm such an art fan. You know, I mean, I love movies and books and music so much. It's all I live for. And I was about 20 pages into this book and I was laughing and I was enjoying it. And then this terrible feeling came over me. And I was like, Ethan, what is this feeling? And I realized it was jealousy. I was so jealous of the gift that you possess. You know, like, you know, it's like, you know, when you listen to, I don't know, whether it's Bob Dylan or Miles Davis, and you just hear originality and you go, your whole life as an artist, you're working. But you know, there's a difference between hard work and grace, you know? And that book, then I gave over. This, once I acknowledged that I was like, okay, just give it up, Ethan, just give it up. And then it just got better and better. And I realized, like, well, all right, I can't have written this, but I could act the hell out of it.
So you then take like a year, I guess, right? Am I right about this, to work on the script? And I don't know to what extent James was involved with that.
I was just the consultant. I mean, Ethan and Mark Richard and the team of screenwriters and Ryan, Ethan's wife, they were the ones who really, they just used the book as the Bible and they went forth. It wasn't anything for me to do because they really understood the story. And, you know, you got to get out the way. You know, look, if you're Duke Ellington and you hand a guy a piece of music, you want him to put his thing to it. That's it.
Yeah.
You get out the way, you know.
I mean, that actually sort of answers what I was going to ask. I thought it was really a funny thing that Ethan said that he had learned from Denzel Washington when they did Training Day, when you guys did it, that we're going to do this prayer sequence where you were going to improvise. And that's a way to get around the studio. And I'm reading a quote to you. If they see the words in the script, they get scared and note you to death. If you just improvise it, they think they're brilliant for hiring you. So obviously James was cool with that, right? He just let you go ahead. He didn't say, that's not my words.
Well, the truth is I was trying to channel James's vision of this character, right? And the notes were not going to be from James. The notes were from people that think, you know, there were studios, if they see a character has a long monologue, they're like, what are you doing with eight sentences? You got, I mean, Orlando Jones is in the movie and he plays the rail man. And he came to set because I just sent him the book. I love Orlando's work. And I sent him the book and said, would you play the rail man? And we talked on the phone and he said, yeah, we had a great conversation. And then he got the script and he calls me up and he says, McBride wrote this great character. And now I've got like three sentences of this great character. Like what happened to the rail man's voice? And I'm like, Orlando, you're a grown up. I'm a grown up. You think the studio wants to see that monologue? Just do it. You underline the book, you write it down in your notes and just do it. And everybody will be blown away. But if they see it, people have these rules. You know, they think they went to one screenwriting class and they think, well, a scene has to be 3/4 of a page long. A scene has to be, can't be longer than 3 pages. And they don't know that Orlando's got a delivery like William Shakespeare. They don't know that that guy can do 12 sentences in a breath. And they'll be nuanced and rich and wild. And then everybody will go, wow, what a genius. See, I told you we should hire him. And and so sometimes if you, it's kind of like with your mom, you know, if you ask, you might get told no. So don't ask, just do it.
So you had Jason Blum, I don't know when Jason signed on and Showtime signed on. Just walk me through that business part.
Well, James and I had a conversation and, you know, I kind of presented James with a grand overview of how I thought the script and the layout of it should work. I got James's approval to take it to Jason. And you know, the thing about Jason is he plays by his gut and he just immediately loved it, you know, and he was all in. I mean, he knows a lot more about television and the marketplace than I do. You know, I had originally envisioned it as 5 episodes. He told me, look, that's a tougher sell. And like, you know, and we got to bring show. He had a vision of how the good Lord Bird could intersect with the marketplace without losing its integrity. And, you know, and because we're friends, I could say to him, I could say, listen, I met this guy, James McBride, and there's no way in hell that this is going to be over. And this guy's going to be disappointed in me. So if this is going to get screwed up, I don't want it to happen. You know, I gave this man my word. And so this is not a joke. This is not a job. This is my life's goal. You know, like this is, and we're friends. And so he can see the look in my eye and go, okay, if the friendship's going to maintain, this is one of those moments. Like, you don't have to help me, but if you're going to help me, you have to help me, you know?
Do it right. Do it right.
And because, yeah. You know, that's what happens when you meet a fellow artist on the way, and I had to have a positive impact on James's journey or I'd hate myself.
Coming up after a short break, McBride talks about the handshake deal that gave Hawk the rights to his novel. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, we're talking to Ethan Hawke, creator of the Showtime series, The Good Lord Bird, and James McBride, author of the award-winning novel on which it's based. The Good Lord Bird is a risky bit of storytelling. It's a comedy set in America's dark past, when abolitionist John Brown set out on a doomed mission to eradicate slavery. In real life, Brown fought for freedom alongside some of the great heroes of the era, including Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman. In the novel and in the series, Brown's young protege, an escaped young slave, follows Brown as he encounters these historical figures. The Good Lord Bird blends fact and fiction, and the series comes with a warning tagline. All of this is true. Most of it happened. There are some tough things in there. You know, James, you paint a picture of Frederick Douglass that is not aligned with the myth of Frederick Douglass. He's a much more Well, he's presented as a dilettante, really, and a carouser, and not a guy who just enjoys the comforts of his fame too much. And then there's John Brown himself, of course, who has this period in Kansas where there's just constant bloodshed and battle. I don't know if you had any concerns about, I mean, I guess starting with James, that this would be swallowed by a Hollywood media company or rejected, or you just let it go and let Ethan fight it out.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, if you write with that, if you're writing to Target, you might as well just write, you know, work in advertising or something. I mean, you have to be free. So I didn't really care. I just wanted to be funny. You know, I know Frederick Douglass is a great man. And if this makes people talk about him and study his work more, then it's good. I mean, he and John Brown were very close friends. It just turns out that Fred, he wasn't all about camping out at night and fighting from the trenches and so forth. So it just was too delicious in a series, in a book of caricature. You know, it's too delicious to talk about. A guy's married to a black woman and he's got a white mistress and they're both living in the same house. I mean, that's just too, yeah. In a book that's funny, you can't, I mean, that's a hanging curve. That's a softball.
So Ethan, when you did sort of the same question, was there blowback or pushback about, you know, this is irreverent towards people who are worshipped, or this John Brown guy is really complicated and killed a lot of people, or, you know, did they, what was that process? Because they did reschedule the thing and I'm not sure why exactly.
I hope he wouldn't mind me saying this, but I once had the pleasure of having coffee with Chris Rock, and I told him I was working on this. And he said to me, well, you got guts. I said, what do you mean? He goes, you know, talking about race in America is a little bit like stepping into the ring with Mike Tyson. Most people get knocked out in the first 90 seconds, you know? Mm. And he said, look, you just got to keep fighting, you know, and trust your heart and trust your intentions. And you're going to get a lot of blowback. He said, you know, there's going to be a lot of people that don't want you to do this or have a reason why you shouldn't do this or don't want it to happen or think you can't be funny or think you can't be this. He said, you just have to lead with your heart, you know, and keep fighting. And it, as the show progressed, I thought an awful lot about that because, you know, everybody's scared. You know, people who invest a ton of money, they'd be idiots not to be scared. We live in a culture where sometimes it feels like the Tower of Babel. You know, everybody's got an equal voice. And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's scary. And so to make something incendiary about a subject matter that means so much to all of us is definitely dangerous. And you're definitely going to get blowback. But as, you know, John Lewis tells us, that's the good kind of trouble. You know, right. You know, James likes to quote right. John Lewis about that. And there's a wrong kind of trouble and there's a good kind of trouble. And it doesn't mean people won't be mad at us but at least they'll be talking about Frederick Douglass. At least they'll be talking about John Brown. At least, and that's the job of the artistic community, is to lead conversation. We don't have to be right all the time or, you know, be perfect guides.
Well, let me just try to sort of make it a brief. How hard did you have to fight?
I don't want to tell you. it's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Wow. And can you explain what the schedule change was about? It was supposed to come out earlier. I mean, the moment.
The schedule change is not what we're talking about. It's making a limited series. If you have aspirations like James had when he wrote it, I had the aspiration, not just me, my wife, Ryan Hawk, Mark Richard, we all the cast, everybody, we had lofty aspirations of making a piece of cinema. You know, we wanted to make an epic movie of James's novel. And that's like making 3 or 4 indie movies back to back.
Yeah.
Worrying about the weather every day for 5 months. Is it going to rain? Is it not going to rain? Is Orlando's plane going to be on time? Is David going to be able to come back for that scene? Oh, wait, Steve Zahn's got another job. You know, I mean, there's the macro things like talking about race in America. And then there's the micro things, like how difficult it is to ask human beings to recreate a failed slave insurrection where 9 people are hung. You have to ask white actors to cheer, and you have to ask African-American actors to reenact this terrible events. And if you show it too much, it's gratuitous violence. And if you don't show it enough, then you're not speaking to the actual crime that happened. And all at the same time, I'm supposed to make it funny. And so it was a razor's edge that we were walking as a group. I mean, I'm an individual. There were directors involved, brilliant directors, set designers, actors who asked invaluable questions, costume people, the right costume that shows the poverty but gives the human being their dignity. You know, like all, it's all hanging on a razor's edge. So it was hard.
I can imagine. At this point, I don't know. Do you feel like it's getting out there? And are you feeling that you're getting the dialogue that you wanted? Because you started this before we had this moment in our history where it's not the first time where suddenly there's a big conversation about race. The hope is that this time it doesn't just dissipate into the air. I don't know, I'd ask James, having seen this now, how do you feel?
Well, I've been living this all my life. And, I feel pretty convinced that young people now have taken the mantle up in a way that I never dreamed would happen. That this happened to fall at this right at this time is just God's will. So let it roll out as it will. The conversation will come and go, you know, as God deems it. But what John Brown did lasted this long. And all of the people who called him crazy and the historians who wrote books about him, depicting him as a nut, they're all, you know, all of that stuff is gone now. And we're here now, and he's walking into the living rooms across this country and across the world. And I think that says everything about what needs to be seen. You know, you have to look at the long run of the big picture. And in the big picture, you just do what you can. You do what you can do where you are. So I hope that's what we've done here. In terms of, you know, what's happening now, well, you know, look, at a certain point, you have to just force your will on somebody else. Now, we've reached the point now where we just have to force our will on the other side. And they won't like it, but they'll get over it. Because as a black person, we've been living on the bottom rail for a long time. And we've been watching the goalposts get moved back and forth, up and down, watch the rules get changed every time. It happens all, it's been happening all my life. So now, you know, the truth, you know, we roll back the business of reality, and millions of Americans who are not black are seeing the reality that we have lived all my life. And so let it roll as it will, and we'll be fine. As long as we just keep loving each other and stop hating on each other because we happen to look different or smell different or wear our hair different or have a different sexual appreciation and so on, so identity. As long as we just get cool about that, and we're going to have to, we'll be fine. And if we don't, then we'll suffer the ways that America suffered after John Brown. You know, the good Lord Byrd is it's a story that tells us the blood has already been shed. So let's learn from it and do what the people then wanted us to do, which is to really, as Rodney King said so eloquently and so simply, just simply get along.
James McBride is an executive producer of The Good Lord Byrd and the author of the novel of the same title. Ethan Hawke is the creator and star of The Good Lord Byrd. Thank you both for your time. It was great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And that's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program with help from Mario Diaz. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.